Hello, this is Marty Hunt. I'm at 9 Glenwood Street in Hudson, New York, with Maria McLaughlin. And we're going to talk about her life, how she came to Hudson, and how life is for her in Hudson. So, Maria, would you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Maria McLaughlin, and I came to Hudson about 5 years ago. From Camp Hill, Minnesota, where my husband and I were house parents, along with our two children, Oliver and Curtis. They're now ages almost 10 and 6 and a half. And I love Hudson. This is my home.
I forgot to say that after you stop talking, I'll always give a pause in case you want to continue on. Mm-hmm. But don't worry, I'll ask another question if, you know, you don't. We're not going to sit in silence for a long time. So, and anything you say is of interest. Mm-hmm. So let's continue then. So tell me how you got to Camp Hill, Minnesota.
Okay. Well, when I went to college, I was studying criminal justice, initially with the intention of becoming going into the FBI. I found out that I could not pass the medical exam because I was born with hydrocephalus, which is a neural tube defect. And so I was automatically disqualified from that. And then I decided I was going to try to join the Peace Corps. And the same thing happened. I was medically disqualified from joining the Peace Corps when I graduated. So I started working on my degree in criminal justice, thinking I would get a master's of social work eventually. And I did some casework with abused and delinquent children while I was also putting myself through college working at group homes for adults with special needs. And that was wonderful, but the casework was really difficult emotionally for me. Like, I just always took my work home with me, and I felt like I was making everything look wonderful on paper, and I was not actually doing any real work, to help people specifically. But so what happened when I was about to graduate, I should backtrack. I had a rough 6 months when I was a junior in college. I had a lot of trouble with hydrocephalus, and I had 9 brain surgeries in the span of 6 months. And while I was there, I met a young man with special needs who was about to go into surgery the same time that I was. And I told the nurses, this man was really giving them a hard time. And in a place that was so depressing, I told the nurse that I love that guy. He's so like full of life and vigor in a place that is really just sad and depressing. And the guy just rolled his eyes at me. And, you know, but it turns out both of our mothers were talking to one another. And my mom said that I had worked in a group home with adults with special needs. And and so his mom came to visit me as I was recovering and was like, yeah, I hope, you know, good luck with your work. I hope, you know, goes well. We need more people to work with people like Charlie in the world. And so I just forgot about that experience. I got better and I got well and life was good. And then when I was having all these feelings of discontent at working with the abused and delinquent kids, just feeling like I wasn't accomplishing much, I started looking for anything but a 9-to-5 job when I was about to graduate. And I found Camp Hill, Beaver Run, the children's village, on an AmeriCorps website. And so I applied and I went to visit, and I thought it was very strange in a really nice way. So I thought it was something I wanted to explore. And then when I graduated, I went there and I never left Camp Hill. I've never used my degree, but I think I have used it. It's just not in the way I initially planned. But the interesting thing was, to backtrack to that gentleman that I met, when I got to Beaver Run and I was visiting it, my mom was like, Maria, I think that that is where that young man lives. And I was like, no, you think so? And so I asked someone, because she knew his name, and they were like, yeah, he's down at the pool, you should go visit. And I went down there, and his mom just happened to be there, and I was like, "Do you remember me?" And she couldn't believe it. Yeah, it was just really cool. I was like, "I'm definitely where I'm supposed to be. This is neat." So, but anyway, so after I had been in Beaver Run for about 5 years, I became pregnant with my husband. We got married, and I had to leave because he was uncomfortable with living in the village. Like, he didn't want to be, he's a private guy and he's a, you know, an introverted person. And so, like, he just felt like he wouldn't have enough privacy living in the village. So we moved out, but I was really unhappy. And then he ended up being pretty unhappy at the job that he was in. So he was like, "Well, what about an adult village? You know, I noticed there's like, positions open for house parents in Minnesota," and we were both just looking for something different. So we went there and it was great. But again, I think he had trouble with, not having privacy. And so when an opportunity came for him to get a job here, working as outreach for, coworker development, like just finding coworkers to work in Camp Hill. But we would be in the vicinity of all these lovely Camp Hill villages and initiatives. It just seemed like the best of both worlds. Ended up being just that. So, like, it took me like a year to get used to it. Like, I was really sad to leave the village. I was lonely because, you know, first my children had these aunties and uncles that were, you know, like in our house, and they would, you know, bounce my kids on their knee. And then all of a sudden it was just us in this big house. But, you know, Hudson's a small town, and yeah, I love it here. So it's good. And we, in the interim, we have managed to, like, Camp Hill Hudson has expanded, and our neighbors were selling their house. And so, you know, we thought Camp Hill Hudson would be interested. So now Camp Hill Hudson owns the house next door to us. So I have a lovely man who lives next door to us, and he's our neighbor, and he comes over and plays with our dog and asks for his key when he locks himself out. And, you know, it's nice. It really is. It's a good balance for us, I think. So that's the long version.
That's good. And so how have your children adjusted? It's a change. Of course, mm-hmm. They were pretty small in Minnesota.
Relatively, but... yeah. Curtis was 1.5 when we left. So he really, this is his home. He doesn't remember anything else so much. Oliver, it was really hard when we first moved. Like, I think just being just him and I, like I said, you know, he had all these other people in our house to entertain him when I was doing the dishes, and all of a sudden it was just me and him. And yeah, so that was hard for him. And also just the culture of Hudson versus the Midwest. Like, we would be walking down the street in Hudson and Oliver would say hello to everyone. It was a thing in I whispered that. To everyone. And in Minnesota, like, you could just be driving down the street and people would wave to you. and it was, yeah, such a different thing, you know. And also when we moved here, I think the moving truck pulled up and Oliver jumped down and said, "I have to go to the bathroom." And he went in the front yard. And I was like, "Whoa, we're not in the farm anymore." But no, he's fine now. I think he likes it. So I think one of the second things that happened after the moving truck pulled up was that there was an ice cream truck that went down the street. And that was also something he had never seen before. So he was pretty
sold.
Happy. He was happy about that. Yeah. Yeah. So he's good.
Do you mind my asking, did you grow up in the city or in the country? Or
I grew up in suburban Philadelphia. It was, yeah. I don't think I've lived in a place similar to the place I grew up since I moved out of my parents' house when I was 18. So, yeah, I mean, it was very, it was a town probably twice the size of Hudson, but it was different in that, like, Hudson's a small town and everyone knows each other. Perkasie, I didn't even know my next door neighbors. Like, it was just very much a bedroom community where people, like, commuted to Philadelphia for their jobs and minded their own business. And it was, you know, not diverse at all. And I think it was a decent place to grow up, but I would never want to settle there for myself. My mom still lives there and she's happy and I visit her happily. And but yeah.
So what do you think about Camp Hill Hudson?
I like it a lot. It's interesting. Like, it's been hard transition, like I said, you know, moving from living in a village to living in Camp Hill Hudson, because it's, but every Camp Hill that I've ever lived in, Beaver Run and Camp Hill Minnesota and Camp Hill Hudson, they're like snowflakes, you know, they're all different. And I think the thing that I had to get used to was it not being like a village that was by itself. It's more like a village within a village. I had never lived in an urban community before. So that was different, but also I just feel like it was, I don't know, I can feel that we are much more part of the fabric of a larger community, and that can feel nice to me. I really feel like it's more visible that we can, you know, be regulars at the, you know, restaurants downtown, and everybody knows their name, and, you know, with Portraits of Us, which is a play that was done by the Camp Hill Hudson Players. It was performed at the Opera House, and it was so wonderful for me to watch it. I just thought it was like incredibly brave and true. Like the premise of it was that people with special needs were their little vignettes, talk either monologues or skits talking about real life experiences that they had living as a person with disabilities in town. You know, and it was just, it's not like a regular play where you get up and you, yeah, you're playing a character, right? But instead of like just standing up and performing lines, you're actually like laying yourself so wide open and saying like, this is what life is like for me. And I was just so admired, like my friends with special needs from Camp Hill Hudson. Like in that moment, I just felt like this is so true and so needed by the world that like, you're just doing such a service. I just, yeah. And I've been really in awe, like, since then, having experiences being around town with my friends. And they have been approached by complete strangers just saying, like, you changed my life. And it was like, wow, that's, yeah, that's so cool. I don't know. It was wonderful. So I think it's, you know, Camp Hill Hudson is different. And I really feel like, I don't know, I'm sure you're familiar with the Christmas story, but when I left Camp Hill, Minnesota, I told a Christian community priest, I was like, I really feel, I'm so sad right now. I'm like, can you be a person who's alive and still build the brotherhood of a place? And she was like, yes, I think you can. And I don't know whether she was giving me lip service, but I just took that and I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll try, you know. But I really feel like in Camp Hill Hudson, you know, just everything that's going on in the world, like this place is trying to give birth to something that is going to, I don't know, like just see our society into the future. I don't know. I just really feel like that is true. And even though it's different, and I know, like, I feel like, you know, it's kind of like being a vegetarian who eats fish. You're kind of criticized by both sides, you know, whether you're, you know, someone who is so visible in a community who might criticize you for not using a behavioral model for people with special needs and using behavior modification or something like that. Or the opposite end, you know, not using complete life sharing like many Camp Hill villages do. We're something else, but I still think that we strive to acknowledge the light in people, like just whether they have special needs or not. And like, we really do love each other and annoy each other and, you know, like drive each other crazy sometimes, but yeah, I don't know. I still think it's right, and it still feels like Camp Hill to me. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes. For listeners who might not know the phrase, to see the light in someone, could you say a little more about that?
So, I guess, I mean, I consider myself a Quaker, a little bit, even though I haven't attended a Quaker meeting in a little while. It's just kind of, oh gosh, I guess, okay, here's an example. When I first got to Camp Hill, it was described to me by a lovely man named David Schwartz that, you know, as a teacher in a children's village, like, the job as a teacher is to acknowledge a person in a spiritual way. Like, if you see a child or an adult with special needs in front of you, and to acknowledge the part of them. No, I'm not saying this right. It's as though this person is a virtuoso violinist, for example, and they were handed an instrument that was missing a string. And so your job as a teacher was to inspire them to want to play anyway. And I guess that would be the light, is recognizing the virtuoso part. And like, just, yeah, and not only with people with special needs, but I think in Camp Hill, we try to do that with all of us, you know, like whatever our needs are, you know, like it's almost like a cliche, everyone has special needs, but we also like have that, like that element of the virtuoso in us where we are, yeah, there's a spark of what is good and right. And if you acknowledge that in every person that you meet, then you help them to become more like that in their daily life, as opposed to, yeah, maybe when they're tired or grouchy or, you know, the stuff that we all are sometimes.
Thank you, perfect. I wonder about the homeschooling. Why? How did you decide to homeschool your boys?
Well, okay. I had the feeling that I kind of wanted to do it way back when we moved here, which at the time Oliver was not quite kindergarten. He was going to be going into kindergarten. We came here in May and he would have entered kindergarten in September, which he did. And what happened was, I kind of just had the feeling that I wanted to homeschool back then. We had known people in Minnesota that did it, and they had beautiful children who were already grown, and I just saw that it was a lovely thing to do, and like a real, yeah, like a genuine education that was, yeah, I just thought I wanted to try it. And also, I knew that we could never afford Waldorf education, even though I believed in the Waldorf curriculum. And yeah, I thought I'd try it, but my husband was like, he was reluctant because he said, look around us. Like, we live in such a diverse, interesting place. And, but there's also a lot of people in Hudson who, financially or just logistically, because of their family situation, would never be able to do that. And he's like, if all of the people that are able to advocate for the public school system leave, what's going to happen with the rest of it? And I couldn't argue with that. Like, it's very true. And I, you know, as much as I truly do love living in Hudson, like, it needs a lot of help, particularly, I think, school. It was not rated well, and, you know, all of these other things, even though that wasn't the reason that I wanted to homeschool. I just felt like, yeah. So he basically, you know, said, we're just going to be really good parents and like advocate for our kids and see what we can do. And I was like, well, you know, like not even like a month after I said okay to that, there was a friend of mine who said that there was an opening on the Board of Education. And so she was like, you should do that, just because of your background and, you know, like, having worked in casework with child welfare and all of that, and having been through the curative course, like I took a 4-year course on curative education when I was in Camp Hill, in the Children's Village. So she's like, you've been a teacher and you've also been a caseworker. Maybe you could give them a hand. And so I ran for the election. And even though I was doing it the entire time, I was feeling like I was not so sure that I wanted to be doing it. And I got on the school board as well. So anyway, this is a very roundabout way. It was a complicated path in how we came to homeschool Oliver. So he went into public school in kindergarten, and he was there for until second grade. He finished second grade. But it was what the first 2 years that he was in public school, he had a wonderful teacher. And I can say honestly, like, they're all the people that I've met, you know, like, are really lovely. I mean, for the most part, you know, just like anywhere else, I think they're just really, some of them are really good teachers, and all of them are well-meaning and lovely kids. And, but then his year in second, like going into second grade, he had, a teacher who was a long-term sub, and it was actually her very first year actually teaching. And I think, you know, she was a lovely person, and but I think she was a little bit, she found it difficult to differentiate, like, how to find the middle in the classroom that she was in. She had 25 kids, and many of whom were very far behind. And Oliver, he's a precocious kid, you know, like, he was already wanting to learn to read when he was really young and, like, taught himself. And I, even though, like, you know, believing in the Waldorf curriculum, I kind of was almost had to hold him back from trying to do that. But this teacher, who was very well-meaning, was like, oh, you don't have to worry about Oliver, he's going to college. And she'd give him a book and he'd sit in the corner and he'd read, and she wouldn't really teach him or, like, encourage him to interact with other kids. And I was like, wow, I don't know. It just, yeah, it got to the point where he was actually unlearning certain things that he had learned at home. Like, because my husband's a woodworker, and he, like, built things with him all the time, and just, yeah, it just wasn't working out. So that year, you know, through no fault of anyone's, I can say, like, honestly, like, it's not Hudson. Hudson School District is not the reason that we decided to homeschool. I think it just really was that we wanted our kids to be well-rounded, and for who Oliver was, it wasn't going to happen in that situation. And, you know, and honestly, like, we even considered sending our other son, our younger son Curtis, to school, but just logistically, because of all of the other things, we found a very rich homeschooling community in the area, and, like, our kids have had incredible experiences. Like, just really cool. They've met incredible people, like this wonderful man named Bob is teaching my older son Oliver how to, like, he's teaching him Latin, and, like, he has taken classes at a homeschool co-op learning how to build and fix bicycles, and, like, I can't even tell you, like, all the neat experiences in real life that they have had through homeschool that, like, I feel like they were missing out when Oliver was in school. Yeah, I guess, I mean, that's how we came to homeschooling. And I was always concerned about, I don't know, it wasn't me so much that was concerned about it, but everyone around us was really concerned about the social implications of that, you know, like, oh, how are your kids going to be socialized? That's always the first question anyone asks when you're homeschooling your kids. And now I can confidently say that is the least of my worries. Like, I am not worried about it at all, because their social life is so genuine in their interactions with both adults and children that are different ages from themselves. Yeah, it's just incredible that they're able to confidently walk into a store with a couple of dollars and purchase what they need. And if the person says anything to them about why they're not in school, they're like, give them this. They're like, oh, I'm homeschooled. My mom's outside with the dog, you know? And it's, yeah, I don't know. I can't say. And also, too, like, Oliver had some experiences where, like, and I can say, again, this is not a criticism of public schools per se, but it's just the nature of having 25 kids in a class. If a teacher has a bad day and is grouchy toward a kid or unkind or unfair or whatever, and it happens all the time. As a mom, I do that to them too. But the difference is that the next day, I know I was a jerk and I can say, I'm sorry. You know, like, that was really mean of me and I apologize. Whereas the teacher is just going to move on and, like, it's going to be swept under the carpet of, you know, the fabric of life, and this happens. And I think, like, just being able to really see social difficulty through from beginning to end and acknowledging each other is something that is missing from the publicly schooled children's experience when they're in a room full of 25 children of the same age and one adult or two adults. Yeah.
Could you say a little more about how his schooling is embedded in Hudson? How did you find out about other opportunities for him? Are there other families you know also homeschooled?
Yeah, actually, it was very interesting, and I don't think accidental, for whatever you believe. The very week that my husband and I were feeling like maybe we just need to homeschool, I took my kids to Greenport Park Playground, and they made friends with a couple of kids that were playing there. That were, one was similar in age, the other one was like a toddling little girl. And I was talking to their mom, and she was part of a homeschooling cooperative. And I was telling her our, you know, situation, and she was interested in, you know, listening to it, and said, you know, actually, we've homeschooled all of our kids all the way through, and you should really be in touch with this place called the Alternative Learning Center, which is a very long time running homeschool cooperative. Right now there's like about 25 families there that meet up in Ghent every week, and the unifying thing that keeps the Alternative Learning Center working is not an ethos, not a religious or spiritual background, although, yeah, I guess it could be. I think really just the common thread is that they believe in being kind to each other regardless of their differences. I think that's really what's behind it, and it's great because, like, then it gives my children, the way it works is each parent or parent group or whatever gives or offers a course in whatever they feel they would like to teach or feel like they have an expertise in, and that they're also hearing that the children are interested in learning. So we have, like, meetings with the children and, like, talk about what they would be interested in learning about and see if there's a match there. And then, so throughout one day a week, a school day, they can choose, like, all these different classes that they take throughout the day with other children's parents. And, you know, the classroom sizes vary from, like, one-on-one, you know, like, my one younger son took drum lessons, like, just a personal drum lesson from a guy the first semester we were there, and to, like, a class of maybe, like, I think the largest, actually, this semester I was leading a chorus or, like, a singing group that was, I think there were around 10 kids signed up. Maybe 12 signed up and 10 showed up. But, yeah, so it's small, but, yeah, and it's really nice, but that gives the opportunity for conversations and camaraderie amongst the parents and the kids to be able to find their way. And, yeah, and they've also been doing workshops at the Kite's Nest, which I had just heard from seeing flyers all over town, you know. And actually, initially, before I even started homeschooling, I went to a group there that was meeting. About half of the parents there were homeschoolers, and the other half were just thinking about it, and I fell into that group at the time. And yeah, I was just really, I was thinking about it, but not sure of it. And I actually, after that session, put off homeschooling for another year, I think, because of one comment that one very well-meaning person said. And I said, my hope is that my children grow up thinking that they're no better than everyone else, or that, you know, their poop stinks like everyone else. And I'm concerned that if I homeschool them, they're going to, like, feel privileged, or, you know, just have the opinion that they're somehow better than where they're growing up, the people around them. And one of the women there said, actually, that's a very good concern, because, you know, we did have, you know, like, a student say something to that effect. I won't go into, you know, what the whole thing, but she validated that concern for me, and not, you know, like, she was, you know, they had a conversation about it and everything, and I think it was a good learning experience for the child, but I still, like, it put me off enough to, like, think, no, we should try a little bit longer. But I also had the opportunity to meet other parents who were doing it at the time, and to hear their concerns. Like, one woman also said something that I felt rang very true, and she had, just like me, had sent her children to public school, and they were having a rough time. And so she said that when her children went to public school, she felt like they got home and she could make it all better by like comforting them and hugging them and saying it's going to be okay, or trying to like help out. And she said, honestly, now all of their misery comes from me. And I was like that, yep, I could see that. And now having experienced it, that is true. But it's also true that a lot of their joy comes from you too. And you have very intense interactions that lead to a deeper relationship, I think. So it's okay. Yeah. But I've met a lot of people that have just been doing it too. And I think that if I lived maybe in Minnesota too, or, you know, in a place that, if I still even lived inside a village that was more rural, then I probably would be less likely to want to homeschool, because I don't think that they would feel, I didn't want them to feel like I was doing it to protect them. Not that I wouldn't, but I want them to know that I'll protect them whatever happens, but not keep the world out. They're part of where they grow up, and that's, I want them to be part of that. And I don't know. I found, honestly, that in some respects, that they were more protected in the schools than they are now. And yeah, they've had a lot of real life experiences since moving here. And some of it's not so pretty, but I think actually they're probably better for it. And I think that they have had the opportunities to have real conversations with me and other people as they were happening, that have allowed them to, like, I don't know, assimilate. I hope. I don't know. Yeah.
Do you mind saying a bit more about the real life experiences?
Yeah. I'm just trying to think of how I can say this. And okay, well, I won't give names, but so I work supporting people with special needs for Camp Hill Hudson, and a lot of times on the weekends I'm accompanying a lady to church. And there was a man who expressed the need to, his housing situation was not stable, and that he needed help moving from one place to another, and didn't have a car to move. And you know, being a stay-at-home, well, I stay at home during the day anyway. We had time to do that. And so I was like, well, as long as you don't mind my kids coming and they can lift stuff, they're helpful, you know. And he's like, sure. So, his living situation is just much different than ours. Like, we are so fortunate. We have a home, and it's not in question whether we're going to have to leave tomorrow. It's clean, it's relatively quiet, you know, and safe. So anyway, I offered to help this man move, and my kids came with me, and they did. They did a great job. They were very quiet while they're moving things from one place to the next. Like, they barely said a word, actually, but I was just watching them, looking around and just taking things in. And yeah, and the places that we were going were not so nice, you know? And I guess, like, as we were driving home in the car, my younger son, I think, he just kind of just took it, and I don't know how he felt about it, but he didn't ask questions, or maybe he couldn't articulate questions. My older son was like, why is he living in those places? Why doesn't he move to where Grandma lives in her apartment? My mother-in-law lives in Joslyn Commons. And she had a pension and get Social Security, and, you know. So, and I was like, well, yeah, some people's life situations are just not what mine and Daddy's has been. And, you know, if they get sick when they're young and they can't take care of themselves, or and they don't have parents who had gone to college who are able to catch them when times get tough, yeah, and they can't afford it. They just, this is what their options are. It's not the same, and not everything is equal. And Yeah, we're just really fortunate and lucky and blessed in our lives. And he's like, "Well, what's a pension?" And then I explained it, like grandma had a pension, and he's like, "So, mom, do you have a pension?" And it was like, and I was like, "No, I don't have a pension. I work in Camp Hill, and I'm now putting in for Social Security, which I've been doing for like maybe a year now. Not a lot, but I was like, I'm gonna be okay. I'm gonna be okay." And then that was the end of the conversation, and I can tell he's still thinking about it, still thinking about it, and it was months ago. But yeah, so I guess that's an example. Yeah, I don't know.
How have your children related to the people that with disabilities that you work with?
Well, honestly, it's been a little bit different for the two of them. They've had different experiences because my older son was much older when we moved from the village. When we moved to Camp Hill, Minnesota, Oliver was a year and a half old, and we had a gentleman. We had three people living with us with disabilities. Two of them, it was more mental illness and like minor developmental delays. And then another gentleman that had cerebral palsy who had very limited verbal abilities and needed help with everything. He was lovely. He was so wonderful. He called everybody mommy. He called me mommy. He called Oliver mommy. And I think Oliver like grew up with him so from a very tender age, they would argue over toys. They'd be like fighting. They were both at the no stage at the same time, and then Oliver would be like, "No," and he'd be pulling the toy away from Adam, and Adam say, "No," and they'd be pulling it the other direction. And then one day, I remember watching it happen. He was playing with Adam again, and they were getting along this time. And he's like, "Adam, run with me. I want to run." And he's running across the room. And Adam was like, "I'm coming, mommy." And he just couldn't run, And Oliver, like after that, I noticed that the way that Oliver talked to him was different. And yet still, they loved each other, of course, but then still, when we moved and Oliver was almost 5, the other two, like we were struggling to find house parents for the house that we were leaving. And Oliver was like, "Why doesn't Tony and Stephanie take care of Adam?" Like referring to the other people with special needs living in our house, not realizing that they had special needs too, that, just because they could walk, they were not quite the same. We had had conversations about, why they might have angry outbursts. They're working just like you are to try to control their emotions. And so to him, that was just normal. And some people are just different from each other. But I think now, my younger son, like Oliver, I think he's just grown up. These are his friends, and it was incredible. His teacher's kindergarten teacher told me that she was like, "I feel like he just, when someone is having a bad day, he's just okay with it, like he will sit next to that person." And she's like, "I've never seen that in a 5-year-old before. I don't know how you do that." But Curtis, his situation was a little bit different just because he didn't grow up with it in the same house in his awake years, from the time he was 18 months. But he's been around it, but it's different when it's your family. And so, like now, I think, he can run around and he'll say, "Come on in, Chris," to our next door neighbor. And so, yeah, no, it's fine. And we, yeah, I mean, they really are now, like the people in Camp Hill Hudson are like their aunts and uncles. But I have noticed, like, the people that we live with in our Camp Hill are normal to them. But then we go to another Camp Hill village and someone is making a funny noise or doing something that Curtis in particular, my younger son, finds scary, then he'll look at me like, "Is this okay?" So it's different. Like, it's interesting, like what's around you in your immediate surroundings is normal, right? But then, like, if it's somebody else's, version of normal, then it can be a little intimidating when you're 5 or 6. Oliver just takes it in stride. I don't know. But yeah, that's interesting. Does that answer your question?
Yes, they get quite an education.
That's good.
Thank you. So how is this with the Board of Education?
Yeah, it's been a real education. Give me a second. Yeah, I think, like I said, I've met a lot of people who are trying really hard and who are really hoping for the best in public education. I think the biggest trouble is that the institution of public education is so big that there are too many cooks in the kitchen, and the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. Like, not one person can really encompass the whole of what it is. Like, it's not even possible. And so I think, I went into the Board of Ed like having a vague sense that something was off. And now, like, I feel like I know too much. Like, I feel a little bit like I think at this point, even though everyone is well-meaning, the institution of public education has grown to a point where it serves to employ the people that are involved in it, but it doesn't adequately serve most children. And I think the reason for this is, I mean, and this is only my position, and I know it's extreme, and I know it does not represent the Board of Education in Hudson at all. I'm going to say that. But in my opinion, what I have seen and what I have researched, if I compare the way that the United States does public education with countries that are known for really excellent public education, the difference lies in that with our system, the money and the funding that is given to public education serves the employees. With the other countries that are doing it right, I think, the money is attached to the specific child. And so the parents are free to choose, for example, like they can choose to send their kids to a Waldorf school. They can choose to use that money to send their kids to a school that's concentrated in the liberal arts. Or if they want their child to get a Montessori education, they can do that. Or whatever it is, they use that money to decide. And the schools that they have choices from either stay open because they're doing well what they're meant to do, or they close because they fail at it. I think that I spend too much time on the Board of Ed talking about how we can comply with the laws required by the state to put our money here, put our money there. We're required to pay teachers so much more every year, and it's less about how we can catch every kid. And kids are like snowflakes. It's almost an impossible task. You have to have smaller schools that are more concentrated, and yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky. I'm not going to, like, I got a 5-year term, and maybe I'm just not smart enough to be able to really, like, sink my teeth to and wrap my head around all of how you can fix it. But I really feel like the only way to fix it is to completely upskill the whole way that we're doing it and change to what I was referring to at being it more at being more child-centered. But I'm in the unfortunate position where I think I am too emotionally, and I should be, attached to the children that are the generation right now. I can't, in good faith, say, like, let's do away with this, because I know it will be an entire generation who is going to suffer. I don't want my own kids to suffer. I don't want my friends' children to suffer. I don't want all of the people that I know and love in the community who, for them, homeschooling is not even an option. Their kids are going to suffer even more than they are now if we really try to shake things up. So I don't know. And so instead, we kind of hobble along with this like crippled system that's not quite working for most people, but kind of working for some. And I think, you know, Hudson has slowly gotten better slightly over the last few years. But still, I don't think we're quite making it. I don't know. And I signed up for a 5-year term, and I'm doing the best I can, and I'm not going to quit, and I'm not going to give up. And I hope I haven't run into this really. I haven't run into people judging me for homeschooling my children and being on the Board of Ed. I hope that people don't think that I would be doing that to lower my own taxes just to, like, you know, take away from a system that I'm not participating in. But really, I feel like I am participating in it because I live in this town. These children are the future of my community. Like, this is who will be around and be the working force when I am older. And so I think it serves everyone to want it to work. But I don't know that I will be signing up for another term right away. I'm not saying it would never happen, but I feel like my life has changed an awful lot since getting on the board, and 5 years is actually a long time when things change so quickly in this part of my life. My mother-in-law had a stroke and had to move in with us for a short period of time, but now she lives just down the road, like in an apartment she can't drive, so we help her a lot, and just our lives in Camp Hill Hudson have become much more involved, and I went back to work, so I don't have as much time to devote to the Board of Ed as I'd like to. And so I feel like I need to, like, wait a little while longer before I could do it again. But it's been a good learning experience, and I hope that someone who's even better at it than I am will, like, take my place when I'm finished in a year. I don't know. Yeah.
When you're on the Board of Education, do you have a particular role that you fill, or is it... everybody is a generalist, or
I'm the vice president of the Board of Education, but there's the president, the vice president, and then otherwise the rest of our just board members. But the role that it serves is twofold. It's fiduciary, like we are basically deciding the budget, how the funds are used, where they're allocated within the confines of the law. So actually there's very little wiggle room, and that's, I found I actually have very little power. Like I walk into like the schools sometimes and everybody's like, oh, she's on the board, you know, and whispering. But I think they really have no idea how I have zero control over a lot of the things that I do. And it's dictated by union laws, by state education department, by all these other things that are beyond my control really. But then the other part of it is policy making, and I'm on the policy committee, but there again, it's all up to interpretation. And I find that even policies that we write with the best of intentions and try to like make them as good as possible, there are parts of the law that say, like, you know, past practice, you have to continue it with certain, like, you know, employee conditions for the teachers and the teachers' aides. I'm thinking, for example, like, we passed an audiovisual policy, like, saying, like, the reason it came up was, this is a whole can of worms, but they were showing television to children during indoor recess. And, you know, these are 5-year-olds. And it's only like 15, 20 minutes that they get all day to just have a break. And they're like, I don't know, they just need to run around, you know, especially like, you know, when you have like, kids that's just healthy. You need to run around when you're 5 years old. But they didn't have the space. And like, we went through I'm not going to tell you the entire history of that policy. It was painstaking to pass it though, because of resistance from some people from the public who didn't want, like, for example, their students or their children to be outside when the weather was below 32 degrees. Understandably, to some degree, if they don't have the proper clothing or whatever, and we were trying to make that, you know, yeah, remedy that part of it. So, and then the other part was, like, you know, from the teachers union saying, like, this is what we, you know, we use this as tools, you know, educational tools, and, like, this is, like, past practice. You can't change this. It's in our contract that, you know, they do certain things at certain times, and I don't know. I'm giving you, like, the short version of all of it. So it was just, there was a lot of things, and it, yeah, and even after the policy passed, it's still not entirely being enforced because of various loopholes that even the lawyers found, and, like, it's amazing. Like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not, yeah, like I said, I don't know who to blame. No one and everyone, right? It's tricky. Yeah, I don't know. Did that answer your question? I think I got a little
yes,
bit lost in
yes.
there.
No, I got the fiduciary and the policymaking.
Yeah.
How is the Board of Education embedded in Hudson? What kind of role does it play?
I mean, we're meant to really be, like, the people who have our fingers on the pulse of who the whole district represents and serves. I think I'm a relatively extroverted person, and I like being out there meeting people and, you know, to just try to, like, pass on, like, to the other board members and the superintendent and, you know, like, the central administration, at least, what I'm hearing, you know, and if there's a problem that, you know, someone's having that's specific, that it's brought to their attention. But I really feel like the role of the Board of Education is very zoomed out. So I can't, like, go in there and wheedle, you know, like, the actual operations of things or, like, how things get done. We're supposed to be very, like, stick to our role. But yeah, but I do feel like that is part of it, is making sure that people who live in Hudson are represented in what they would like to see in education. And sometimes they come to the meetings, not usually when they're upset, or occasionally when their kids are getting an award for, yeah, something. But we rarely see people at the meetings. People should come more often. I think it's a misconception that the Board of Education is really powerful, that there's just people up there behind closed doors doing something and making decisions on people's behalf without, I don't know, without concern for who they're... And I don't find that to be true at all, especially I really do feel like we have a good group of caring people on the board right now. It's been not always the case that every single person has been, but I can tell you that at this very moment, I think it's a really good group. And we get along well, and, like... And I think oftentimes, like, some of the things that I've been critical of, I have not actually said out loud except to more than, like, one other person on the board who is also my personal friend. Mostly because I just feel like it would be counterproductive to rock the boat to such an extent. I don't want to hold them back, but I also feel like I should speak the truth sometimes, too. I try to find the balance between the two, because I think sometimes those two things are at odds with each other.
Do you have any idea of what other boards of education of similar size towns are doing? Do you have connections?
Mm-hmm. There is a group of small city school districts, it's a very niche thing that doesn't happen very often, but there's a group of them in our state that have similar demographics and have, like, we have big city problems but small town politics and everything, which is a very unusual juxtaposition of things. But yeah, and they meet regularly to talk about our our struggles or our successes. And I think one of the biggest successes that we've had in Hudson is that we have an incredibly creative and caring, you don't always feel the caring part, but like just really many people in the town itself that are supportive of their own initiatives, and that it spills over to their interest in children. Like we have this lovely man named Peter Meyer who does like a journalism class with the middle school, and he's a journalist. And like we have grants that were written like to do things like Greater Promise Neighborhood, and like so that kids who might otherwise be latchkey kids actually have like a real community to like a place to plop their backpack after school and get help with their homework. And you know, like I really feel like this town is like buoyed by like all of the awesome people that live here, like through grant funded programs specifically. And also, like, yeah, I just think that that has helped. And, yeah, I don't know. I know I meandered a little bit on that one. But, yeah, but we do, I mean, we're in touch with the other small city school districts. And I do think that it's helpful to, like, be able to, like, talk about where they have been able to pull different streams of, and I'm talking about money again, but really, like, that's, like, you know, for example, we were able to get my brother's Keeper grant that has been really helpful with, you know, just like developing social emotional skills in young people that might not have, they might have a home life situation that has been less than ideal, but they have a support system through this program. They're able to like, and oh, the other one is that's really good is Power of Peace. This lovely man named Mike, he comes and talks to our kids, and like just he really is able to draw them out and like see how their life situations or their circumstances are not indicative of what their future has to be, you know, and also just that they're not alone in it either. And yeah, I don't know, I think it's really good. And that's not, it's funny because like all of these things were not what I had growing up and going to a public school. Like none of that existed. But yeah, I also didn't grow up in a small city, but it's yeah.
Can you say more about these programs? My Brother's Keeper and
mm-hmm.
the Power of Peace.
I mean, I don't know like all the details of all of them. I'm the Power of Peace I actually participated in. That one I can say like it's very powerful. I mean, this lovely man, Mike, that I was telling you about, he grew up in a situation that was like he grew up very poor, and his situation was not ideal for like making it in life or doing, you know, well and being self-actualized. But so he already starts off, you know, sitting around a circle of like young kids, and he like brings like this picture of the house that he grew up in, which is not a nice house and like barely standing really in a place that is not so nice. And he's, you know, so already, like, he just gives people hope, I think, and that, like, just because you are in this situation that it doesn't always have to be your situation, you know, and which is a hard thing to see. I think one of, he asks every single person in the room pointed questions, and they all just sit there and tell their stories, and you start to see, like, you're actually not all that different from each other. And you know, I don't know, I think it increases camaraderie and like decreases, like it's more of what those, remember what I was saying, how like the social interactions like are not like complete when you have, you know, like to keep 25 students in line, but this program in particular mitigates that, I think, by like allowing students and teachers who also occasionally join the group are able to relate to one another in a real life sort of way. And I think it's healing. And our world needs healing right now. So, yeah, I don't know. I can't tell you all of the program. Yeah, there's many more, but I don't know the details of all of them. But, yeah.
Will your boys have access to such programs, or can you make something similar?
It depends. Actually, I can say the one program, not all of them. And it depends on even the Power of Peace program, they pull out a select few, there's only so many students that can join every, and it's a small percentage, but they change, they rotate so that they're trying to catch everybody. I think my kids are probably not their number one priority, which is okay. And I've run into that many, many times, but I know that they are privileged, so I'm okay with that. The one thing that both my kids have taken advantage of is a grant-funded program that was specific to the district, and the district as in the land, and not to the school per se, and that was Harmony Project. My older son was in it for 3 years, I believe, but then this past year he wanted to take that Latin class that I was telling you about. And he can't do everything. So he had to choose, and he was unable to continue Harmony Project. But my younger son is in it now too. And they really, they build a community around music for kids. And they have different grown-ups, adults who are professionals in their instruments come in and play for them. And they also teach them to sing together and teach them music theory and teach them, they start to play the recorder in first grade, and then they also move on to another instrument when they're the next year, and they basically slowly are building an orchestra that they will hopefully go all through school together with, learning music together, and it's wonderful, and I like it. So my younger son's in that now, so we'll see how it goes, because the thing is that I've found that's a challenge to have them both, take advantage of programs that publicly schooled kids can have and also do the homeschooling thing, is that those things aren't always on the same schedule. There's this phonetic rhythm that happens when you're in public school. You come to school at 8 o'clock, you leave at 2:15. The after-school programs are between this hour and this hour, and then, and if you can't catch that because you're at a co-op one day or because you're taking an art lesson somewhere else, but, it doesn't, But like I said, you can't do everything, and I think that they're okay. Yeah.
Can we go back to this idea, this conviction that you have that it's going to take really a sea change in order to improve education overall, so that it's meeting the needs of the children? Can you say a little more about, in an ideal world, how that sea change could be accomplished? Yeah. Or anything about that?
Yeah. I think, so some of, I feel like since beginning homeschooling, some of my kids' most valuable experiences have come from them asking a question. And I say this because, I think back when I went to school, I was taught things in a group of 25 other kids, and I'd say I retained maybe 5% of it, into my adulthood. And I think the reason for that is because I either was told it at the wrong time and I wasn't ready to hear it, or it wasn't what I needed to hear. And, the things that I can say, I have to, as a homeschooling mom, to, test my children in order to continue doing it. So there are certain places where I have to play ball and teach them math and English language arts, just like the publicly school kids get, just so that they can pass their tests. But that only takes up this much of our time. And the rest of it, my one son has been extremely interested in wolves this year. And he just, we just sunk into it. And, we're so... oh, no, I'm sorry. That's my phone.